With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today here on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, the last 12 months have brought some positive market changes for almonds, and the NRCS is offering opportunities to address conservation priorities in California. But our top story today, U.S. farming is still primarily a family business. The USDA's Economic Research Service released a report titled America's Farms and Ranches at a Glance, 2023 edition. Catherine Lacey, an ERS economist and co-author of the report, says the overwhelming majority of U.S. farms are still family operations.
A majority of farms are considered small family farms, but these farms only account for 19% of the value of production. On the other hand, 3% of farms are large-scale family farms, accounting for 25% of agricultural land operated and 52% of the value of production.
Small family farms made up 88% of the total farm count. Overall, the study found that 97% of all U.S. farms were family farms, and that accounted for 90% of farm production in 2022. She talks about commodity specialization.
We can see large-scale family farms dominate the production of most commodities, including beef, hogs, cash grains and soybeans, cotton, dairy, and specialty crops. In the remaining commodities, poultry and eggs, and hay, small family farms and mid-sized family farms dominate the production. The value of production for non-family farms was less than 20% for all commodities. If you compare this report to last year's edition, you will notice the value of hog production and specialty crop production increased for large-scale family farms and decreased for non-family farms. However, the value of production shares in 2022 was similar to the shares seen in 2019 and 2020.
Lacey talks about the financial health and risks of America's farms.
Most small family farms have an operating profit margin in the high-risk zone. Generally, we see the share of farms in the high-risk zone decrease as farm size increases. The majority of mid-size and large-scale family farms are in the medium-risk zone or low-risk zone. Finally, in terms of financial risk, non-family farms are more similar to small family farms than large-scale family farms.
About 20% of all U.S. farms held any debt in 2022, and 67% of farms carrying debt used one lender. ERS also looked at farm income.
In general, farm households are not considered low income. Only retirement farms and low sales farms had median income below U.S. household median income. Median farm household income greatly increases as farm size increases, with very large farms having a median household income of approximately $1.4 million.
Catherine Lacey of Economic Research Service. The USDA is out with updated agricultural trade numbers for this year and a forecast for 2024. Gary Crawford has details.
Last year, we saw U.S. agricultural export and import values growing, with imports in 2022 growing faster than exports. But so far, in the first 10 months of this calendar year,
now we're seeing decreases in both.
Both export values and imports. USDA economist Bart Kenner says for the first 10 months of this year, the calendar year, ag exports were at $143.3 billion.
Down 18.2% from the previous year. Agricultural imports are $163.3 billion, down 3.1%. from last year.
And as we said earlier, import values had been growing rapidly due partly to inflation, sending unit prices much higher. But Kenner says,
so that inflation has started to ease and volumes are continuing to stay pretty consistent. And so we're starting to see some of that decrease in import value overall over last year, as those prices start to come down a little bit.
And of course,
we're seeing decreased unit values in exports as well.
So taking a look at the big four bulk commodities and their export values.
Exports of wheat for January through October 2023 are $5.3 billion, down 29% from last year. Corn exports are $11.1 billion, down 33% from last year. Soybean exports are $21.4 billion, down 10% from last year, and cotton exports are $5.4 billion, down 35% from last year. from last year.
So the overall value level of U.S. exports is declining. USDA recently put out its forecast for fiscal year 2024, which we're in now, projecting exports to fall another 5% below this past fiscal year. Again, mostly due not to declines in the volume of exports, but in the unit prices. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
We will be back in just a moment with more of the day's headlines and our livestock report with Will Jordan when we return. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, a new partnership between Midwest Dairy and Dollar General is helping Midwest Dairy reach consumers to build trust and increase demand. Michael Klimitz shares more.
Martha Kemper, Midwest Dairy Vice President of Dairy Experience, talks about the new partnership and unique ways Midwest Dairy is reaching consumers.
Well, Midwest Dairy is dedicated to listening to consumers and meeting their needs by working with and through partners. We work through sales partners, including restaurants, grocery, and convenience stores, to give consumers an excellent dairy experience. Our goal is to maximize dairy farmers' checkoff investment impact by working with and through these partners to share information and real-time experiences that showcase how dairy products resonate with today's consumers to increase dairy sales. And one of our newest and most exciting partnerships is with Dollar General.
The effort began as a joint program with Midwest Dairy and the United Dairy Industry of Michigan, but has continued to grow as other dairy checkoffs joined. The partnership will increase awareness and sales of fluid milk through strategically placed in-store signs through January 14, 2024.
Dollar General shoppers, we've learned, spend more time in-store than shopping online. And in fact, 82% of purchase decisions were made while in-store. So that's why an in-aisle signage program can make an impact on sales. So we accomplished this by putting signs that promote affordable nutrition, by promoting milk as a good value, using the new Undeniably Dairy tagline, Real Milk, Real Nutrition. So this in-store signage will appear in the dairy section, in front of dairy milk, and in the cookie aisle to remind consumers to not forget the milk. As a reminder, Dollar General has over 2,300 stores in the Midwest Dairy 10-state region. The partnership has really been a popular request from farmers, so we're very excited to deliver and connect shoppers with dairy products just in time for the holidays, by the way.
Kipper says Dollar General is a natural fit for a partnership with Midwest Dairy.
Well, Dollar General is the number two grocery destination in the United States behind only Walmart and has a national footprint of over 19,000 stores in 47 states. 75% of Americans live within 5 miles of a Dollar General location. And as we're all aware, inflation is really kind of pushing more consumers than ever to make price-conscious food purchases. So this partnership with Dollar General will allow Checkoff to meet consumers where they are shopping, the dollar store channel.
Partnerships such as this one are an integral part of the work at Midwest Dairy, as reaching consumers at their favorite local grocers helps to grow sales in dairy.
In a different in-store signage campaign, we placed in-store signs at 1,900 grocery stores in the Midwest Dairy region. This signage focused on the healthy habits that start with milk, really highlighting dairy's nutritional value. We just concluded this program and are really eager to learn the results. Checkoff is really confident in the value of retail signage campaigns as we work to continue to increase dairy sales. As mentioned, this partnership has been a popular request from farmers, and we're really very excited to deliver and connect shoppers with dairy products. We're exploring more opportunities to include in-store signage at other brick-and-mortar retailers and really look forward to sharing more about our partnerships in the future.
With that in mind, Kemper says the Dairy Checkoff will continue its work in driving demand for dairy farmers.
We are continually looking for effective ways to encourage consumers to purchase more dairy products, and this includes in-store signage like this Dollar General campaign, or through recipe inspiration that incorporates dairy in new ways in snacks and meals for consumers. That excellent dairy experience is what continues to keep dairy on the list, in the basket, and going through the register to consumers' tables.
To learn more about activities and programs driving trust and sales of dairy products, visit MidwestDairy.com. Michael Klimitz reporting.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with today's Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, earlier this month, the Protecting Interstate Commerce for Livestock Producers Act was introduced in Congress. Introduced as a way to protect farmers across the United States from legislation from other states which are detrimental to farmers and costly to consumers. largely as a response to California's 2018 Prop 12, whose certification requirements go into effect in 2024, the bill is intended to safeguard food systems and production agriculture from negative and adverse policies. The bill's sponsor, Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, said livestock producers keep food on the table across America and they shouldn't be burdened by costly laws made by other states that disrupt interstate commerce, drive up costs, and impose crippling regulations. This law is a common sense solution to protect family farms from going bankrupt and consumers from shouldering high costs at the grocery store. To ensure that no state can mandate animal welfare standards in another state, Senator Hawley's Protecting Interstate Commerce for Livestock Producers Act preempts state and local governments from regulating the raising, production, and importation of livestock or livestock-derived goods from another state or local government. However, it does allow states to regulate the importation of livestock in the event of animal disease, and it protects farmers from states implementing laws that are preempted by this bill. It should be noted that the bill is not written to get rid of animal welfare, but extinguish exercise of undue interstate power by state governments. The bill is written to simply prevent laws to be enforced upon farmers and ranchers in jurisdictions that they are not represented. According to the bill's language, it is a preemption of state law, rule, or ordinance that is incongruent with, disproportionate to, or otherwise in conflict with any applicable regulation under the laws, rules, or ordinances of the state or local subdivision in which the applicable livestock or livestock-derived goods are raised or produced, or imposes any requirement that present in the laws, rules, or ordinances of the state or local subdivision in which the applicable livestock or livestock-derived goods are raised or produced. While some may see this as another unnecessary piece of legislation or political posturing from Washington, its aim is focused on preempting California's Prop 12 and preventing another state from passing legislation that is detrimental to agriculture. California's Prop 12 threw a major shakeup to the ag industry when it passed in 2018, as the National Pork Producers Council reports 15% of domestic pork sales are directed to the California market. Complying with the state's mandate is expected to be a multi-billion dollar cost to producers collectively. In other livestock news, the Sterling Beef Profit Tracker shows red for the week ending December 9th, as the feedlot margin for unhedged cattle shows $100.52 per head in the red. An unpleasant number to see, but one that comes as yards consistently see high heifer placement along with the usual steers. Still with that in mind, the packer margin doesn't hit the break-even mark either, coming in at $22.95 per head below the line. For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Here's Brian German with today's interview.
My name is Eric Morgan. I'm with Braga Fresh. I am the Vice President of Environmental Science and Resources.
And we've talked a couple times before kind of on this subject. You were part of a panel this morning here at the Organic Growers Summit surrounding the idea of regenerative agriculture. And so, number one, I wanted to pick your brain on where you kind of see the tide moving. You had an interesting perspective as to where you see regenerative as it relates to organic.
So for me, regenerative should start off with an organic basis, but I'm just not sure that model will fit for every market in the country. I think for our market, that's what we need to focus on. And I do believe that CDFA is working on defining that right now, and they are looking at allowing some level of gene modification or genetic engineering in. I don't know the other specifics, but for me, you know, for what I know and understand about regenerative, I really do think that it should maintain an organic focus. And that's what I'd advocate for sure. And a lot of that just comes from the experimentation that we've done. And granted, there's been a tremendous number of failures, but what we're learning from the process, we're already taking those lessons and applying it to both our conventional production and organic production and seeing some level of success as well.
There was one point that you had made that I thought was pretty poignant of thinking of regenerative as organic plus, and that seems like a pretty simplistic look at something that's overly complicated, but it seems to make sense.
Yeah, so it kind of depends. I think that there's a number of growers that are probably certified organic and are actually growing regeneratively without any level of certification or even knowing it. growers that, you know, have a ton of biodiversity in the farm, growers that use a ton of compost, growers that have found ways to reduce their tillage, growers that implement livestock rotations through that they may not even pursuing, you know, a regenerative certification. But as far as like it being organic plus, yeah, I do think that, you know, a lot of the organic produce that's being grown is largely being grown with a conventional mindset, a conventional produce mindset with organic inputs. And for me, that's why I think of regenerative being organic plus. Yeah, we're going to take all the synthetic chemistries out of it, but we're also going to focus on soil health and community and labor, and if where possible, you know, livestock integration. We can't do that in our market right now, but you know, there are definitely markets in the permanent crops. You know, I think about Vernon Peterson and his work. You know, they're rotating in livestock there too. So at least using chicken manure. I'm not sure if he's rotating livestock, but it should be organic plus. But that being said, there are organic growers that are already doing that that probably aren't stepping up to take the credit for it.
One thing I wanted to ask you, because you noted various different certifications that are available for a variety of different things. How do you kind of look at those in terms of their value and which ones to adhere to that are kind of keeping with what you're looking to do on the farm in terms of practices and maybe looking towards the future a little bit?
So I would say that one of the things that we struggle with initially is that trying to find a certification that actually works for what we're doing. You know, so many of the certifications are kind of geared towards broadacre crops. And so we do have some level of tillage in our regenerative organic trials that we're doing, which is up to 120 acres now that we've done, coming up from 6 to 120 in like 3 years. But we haven't found a certification that fits perfectly yet. You know, looking at the regenerative organic certification, they do require a third party, you know, labor ethical food initiative type of certification. It's pretty hard for a California grower that offers their employees competitive rates, health care, you know, we're doing everything right, have great employee retention, you know, and then to be put in the same boat as a grower growing bananas in a developing nation. And so that's a little tricky, but at the same time, you know, we are considering it. We do have our retail partners are looking for us to partner with, you know, that type of program. So it's on the radar more and more and more. So that's been one of the hurdles. You know, we have done the kind of enrollment with Regen Score. And Regen Score, I really like what they're doing because they've really just made it, you know, a science-based metric, data intensive. And we did the enrollment for them, and really, you know, the indication would be that we got a perfect score. Unfortunately, the person running that is also trying to finish her postdoc in soil, so she's been a little busy and hasn't been able to really run us back through it. But I'm excited by that because we're doing so many sustainable things on both our conventional side and our organic side that really I think that when you start to take a look and taking a look at what we're doing already for soil health and nutrient management and trying to address our tillage issues and cover crops and all the sustainable practices, we should be able to get credit for that. We should be able to get a score for, even if we're still using synthetic inputs but we're building soil health, we should be able to get credit for that. And because we want the market to know that we're trying harder than anybody else to get there. So,
and one thing that you had noted as part of your story, dealing with pests and you know, taking an approach even in your conventional acreage of an approach that you've applied in organic, because that some of those practices with the IPM seem to be the only thing that was really effective there.
Yeah, so we were talking about it, I don't remember if it was last night or this morning, but you know, there's beneficial insects that are present natively that attack diamondback moth, and we've actually seen that when we, in both our conventional and our organic system, if we use a spinosad-based product, we're hammering adult beneficial insects. And there's some natural predators that when we took the spinosad and all the other products out that harm beneficial insects and just go with BT, we actually saw a reduction in the amount of diamondback moth. And so actually what happened this year, for the second year in a row, is we stopped on our conventional brassicas, we stopped using all of the inputs that we use, the Avant, the spinosad, all these other products that actually harm the adult beneficials that are predators for this pest. And we moved the organic program into the conventional and actually got the conventional looking really, really good. I mean, it's like we had to move organic processes into our conventional to get the crop this year, which is shocking that that's where we're at, that we don't actually have the tools that we need to be able to do it on the conventional side. And that should be telling. That should be telling for growers that right now, you know, whether it's INSV, whether it's Western flower thrips, whether it's Ligus, whether it's, you know, Diamondback moth, there is a host of pests that we have that we don't have great answers for right now. And the pipeline of chemistry, novel chemistry, synthetic chemistry that we've had open for the last 50 years is relatively closed at this point. And so to me, we really need to find a different pathway to get our yield and feed the world. So, and I hope that we're started down that road.
Thank you again to Brian Sherman. Don't forget, if you have missed any of our morning shows, or if you just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have our statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for the AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. And now for more news. At a major climate change conference, U.S. agriculture shows what it's doing to help. David Geiger has this report.
Agriculture had a moment in the limelight at COP28 this year. The climate change conference in Dubai hosted more than 200 nations with the goal to work on climate change. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack was there and says there was a milestone declaration for agriculture and 152 countries signed on.
A declaration that outlines the steps that need to be taken in order to ensure that we can produce the food necessary to meet the nutrition needs of the world now and in the future in light of a changing climate and the challenges that it presents.
Vilsack adds it looks to the future.
I'm excited about this declaration because it lays out a series of commitments and directions that I think are very, very consistent with what the United States Department of Agriculture, the Biden-Harris administration, and the United States farmers and ranchers have been engaged in.
A big change from the last COP, where Vilsack says U.S. agriculture had to argue for its work on climate change.
In this COP, we flipped the script for American agriculture.
And COP28 devoted a full day to how food and agriculture impacts climate change.
There was no need for us to be defensive, but in fact, we could articulate proactive leadership in the climate space. Leadership that I think reflected in a number of opportunities for us to showcase what U.S. farmers and ranchers are doing in a variety of ways to mitigate and adapt to a changing climate.
One of the showcased ideas is the Aim for Climate initiative launched by the U.S. and Arab Emirates in COP26. Vilsack says its goal is to look for innovation sprints in adaptation and mitigation strategies to prevent climate change.
To encourage investment and to encourage acceleration of these innovations into the marketplace to help farmers worldwide. We started with a handful of countries and a few partners and a handful of innovation sprints. We were pleased to announce that in this COP we had reached over 600 partners.
Involving $17 billion in commitments to investing in Aim for Climate initiative projects, double the amount of last year. In that time, the number of innovation sprints nearly tripled to 78. Vilsack also says they showcase the International Climate Hub introduced last spring.
This International Climate Hub provides information available about the innovation sprints, but also is beginning to showcase some of the tools that have been developed by USDA and made available on the International Climate Hub.
I'm David Geiger.
Lawmakers introduced the Fertilizer Research Act into the Senate. One of the bill's co-sponsors, Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, talked about why they introduced the bill.
In recent years, our farmers have faced a lot of headwinds, and one of those challenges has been the spike in the price of fertilizer. Last year, the cost of fertilizer was like a staggering 30% of the input costs.
While prices have gone up sharply in recent years, Baldwin says farmers have no idea why.
At the same time, our farmers have very little insight into why these prices spiked, how they're determined. And so with this legislation, we're hoping to pull back the veil, if you will, of the competition within this market and be able to craft solutions that address the high costs that farmers are facing.
If farmers cannot afford to plant all their crops, that ultimately affects everyone.
high fertilizer prices don't just affect our hardworking farmers. They also can result in elevated prices because they limit the amount that farmers might plant if they can only afford a limited amount of fertilizer. So these are serious issues that affect our economy, and we need to have greater insight and information, and that's what this bill would do.
Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin sponsored the bill along with Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst of Iowa. That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Here's Brian German with today's interview.
My name is Eric Morgan. I'm with Braga Fresh. I am the Vice President of Environmental Science and Resources.
And we've talked a couple times before kind of on this subject. You were part of a panel this morning here at the Organic Grower Summit surrounding the idea of regenerative agriculture. And so, number one, I wanted to pick your brain on where you kind of see the tide moving. You had an interesting perspective as to where you see regenerative as it relates to organic.
So for me, regenerative should start off with an organic basis, but I'm just not sure that that model will fit for every market in the country. I think for our market, that's what we need to focus on. And I do believe that CDFA is working on defining that right now, and they are looking at allowing some level of gene modification or genetic engineering in. I don't know the other specifics, but for me, you know, for what I know and understand about regenerative, I really do think that it should maintain an organic focus, and that's what I'd advocate for sure. And a lot of that just comes from the experimentation that we've done, and granted there's been a tremendous number of failures, but what we're learning from the process, we're already taking those lessons and applying it to both our conventional production and organic production and seeing some level of success as well.
There was one point that you had made that I thought was pretty poignant of thinking of regenerative as organic plus, and that seems like a pretty simplistic look at something that's overly complicated, but it seems to make sense.
Yeah, so it kind of depends. I think that there's a number of growers that are probably certified organic and are actually growing regeneratively without any level of certification or even knowing it. Growers that, you know, have a ton of biodiversity in the farm, growers that use a ton of compost, growers that have found ways to reduce their tillage, growers that implement livestock rotations through that they may not even pursuing, you know, a regenerative certification. But as far as like it being organic plus, yeah, I do think that, you know, a lot of the organic produce that's being grown is largely being grown with a conventional mindset, a conventional produce mindset with organic inputs. And for me, that's why I think of regenerative being organic plus. Yeah, we're going to take all the synthetic chemistries out of it, but we're also going to focus on soil health and community and labor, and if where possible, you know, livestock integration. We can't do that in our market right now, but you know, there are definitely markets in the permanent crops. You know, I think about Vernon Peterson and his work. You know, they're rotating in livestock there too. So at least using chicken manure. I'm not sure if he's rotating livestock, but it should be organic plus. But that being said, there are organic growers that are already doing that that probably aren't stepping up to take the credit for it.
One thing I wanted to ask you, because you noted various different certifications that are available for a variety of different things. How do you kind of look at those in terms of their value and which ones to adhere to that are kind of keeping with what you're looking to do on the farm in terms of practices and maybe looking towards the future a little bit?
So I would say that one of the things that we struggle with initially is that trying to find a certification that actually works for what we're doing. You know, so many of the certifications are kind of geared towards broad acre crops. And so we do have some level of tillage in our regenerative organic trials that we're doing, which is up to 120 acres now that we've done, coming up from 6 to 120 in like 3 years. But we haven't found a certification that fits perfectly yet. You know, looking at the regenerative organic certification, they do require a third party, you know, labor ethical food initiative type of certification. It's pretty hard for a California grower that offers their employees competitive rates, health care, you know, we're doing everything right, have great employee retention, you know, and then to be put in the same boat as a grower growing bananas in a developing nation. To be, and so that's a little tricky, but at the same time, you know, we are considering it. We do have our retail partners are looking for us to partner with, you know, that type of program. So it's on the radar more and more and more. So that's been one of the hurdles. You know, we have done the kind of enrollment with Regen Score, and Regen Score, I really like what they're doing because they've really just made it, you know, a science-based metric, data intensive. And we did the enrollment for them, and really, you know, the indication would be that we got a perfect score. Unfortunately, the person running that is also trying to finish her postdoc in soil, so she's been a little busy and hasn't been able to really run us back through it. But I'm excited by that because we're doing so many sustainable things on both our conventional side and our organic side that really I think that when you start to take a look and taking a look at what we're doing already for soil health and nutrient management and trying to address our tillage issues and cover crops and all the sustainable practices, we should be able to get credit for that. We should be able to get a score for, even if we're still using synthetic inputs but we're building soil health, we should be able to get credit for that. And because we want the market to know that we're trying harder than anybody else to get there. So,
and one thing that you had noted as part of your story, dealing with pests and you know, taking an approach even in your conventional acreage of an approach that you've applied in organic, because that some of those practices with the IPM seemed to be the only thing that was really effective there.
Yeah, so we were talking about it. I don't remember if it was last night or this morning, but you know, there's beneficial insects that are present natively that attack diamondback moth, and we've actually seen that when we, in both our conventional and our organic system, if we use a spinosad-based product, we're hammering adult beneficial insects. And there's some natural predators that when we took the spinosad and all the other products out that harm beneficial insects and just go with BT, we actually saw a reduction in the amount of diamondback moth. And so actually what happened this year, for the second year in a row, is we stopped on our conventional brassicas, we stopped using all of the inputs that we use, the Avant, the spinosad, all these other products that actually harm the adult beneficials that are predators for this pest. And we moved the organic program into the conventional and actually got the conventional looking really, really good. I mean, it's like we had to move organic processes into our conventional to get the crop this year, which is shocking that that's where we're at, that we don't actually have the tools that we need to be able to do it on the conventional side. And that should be telling. That should be telling for growers that right now, you know, whether it's INSV, whether it's Western flower thrips, whether it's ligus, whether it's, you know, diamondback moth, there is a host of pests that we have that we don't have great answers for right now. And the pipeline of chemistry, novel chemistry, synthetic chemistry that we've had open for the last 50 years is relatively closed at this point. And so to me, we really need to find a different pathway to get our yield and to feed the world. So, and I hope that we're started down that road.
Thank you again to Brian German. Don't forget, if you have missed any of our morning shows, or if you just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have our statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for the AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. And now for more news. At a major climate change conference, U.S. agriculture shows what it's doing to help. David Geiger has this report.
Agriculture had a moment in the limelight at COP28 this year. The Climate Change Conference in Dubai hosted more than 200 nations with the goal to work on climate change. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack was there and says there was a milestone declaration for agriculture and 152 countries signed on.
A declaration that outlines the steps that need to be taken in order to ensure that we can produce the food necessary to meet the nutrition needs of the world now and in the future in light of a changing climate and the challenges that it presents.
Vilsack adds it looks to the future.
I'm excited about this declaration because it lays out a series of commitments and directions that I think are very, very consistent with what the United States Department of Agriculture, the Biden-Harris administration, and the United States farmers and ranchers have been engaged in.
A big change from the last COP, where Vilsack says U.S. agriculture had to argue for its work on climate change.
In this COP, we flipped the script for American agriculture.
And COP 28 devoted a full day to how food and agriculture impacts climate change.
There was no need for us to be defensive, but in fact, we could articulate proactive leadership in the climate space. Leadership that I think reflected in a number of opportunities for us to showcase what U.S. farmers and ranchers are doing in a variety of ways to mitigate and adapt to a changing climate.
One of the showcased ideas is the Aim for Climate initiative, launched by the U.S. and Arab Emirates in COP26. Vilsack says its goal is to look for innovation sprints in adaptation and mitigation strategies to prevent climate change.
To encourage investment and to encourage acceleration of these innovations into the marketplace to help farmers worldwide. We started with a handful of countries and a few partners and a handful of innovation sprints. We were pleased to announce that in this COP we had reached over 600 partners.
Involving $17 billion in commitments to investing in Aim for Climate initiative projects, double the amount of last year. In that time, the number of innovation sprints nearly tripled to 78. Vilsack also says they showcase the International Climate Hub introduced last spring.
This International Climate Hub provides information available about the innovation sprints, but also is beginning to showcase some of the tools that have been developed by USDA and made available on the International Climate Hub.
I'm David Geiger.
Lawmakers introduced the Fertilizer Research Act into the Senate. One of the bill's co-sponsors, Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, talked about why they introduced the bill.
In recent years, our farmers have faced a lot of headwinds, and one of those challenges has been the spike in the price of fertilizer. Last year, the cost of fertilizer was like a staggering 30% of the input costs.
While prices have gone up sharply in recent years, Baldwin says farmers have no idea why.
At the same time, our farmers have very little insight into why these prices spiked, how they're determined. And so with this legislation, we're hoping to pull back the veil, if you will, of the competition within this market and be able to craft solutions that address the high costs that farmers are facing.
If farmers cannot afford to plant all their crops, that ultimately affects everyone.
High fertilizer prices don't just affect our hardworking farmers. They also can result in elevated prices because they limit the amount that farmers might plant if they can only afford a limited amount of fertilizer. So these are serious issues that affect our economy, and we need to have greater insight and information, and that's what this bill would do.
Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin sponsored the bill along with Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst of Iowa. That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.